From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We feel in wartime comradeship. We confuse this with friendship, with love. There are those who will insist that the comradeship of war is love, the ecstatic glow that makes us in war feel as one people, one entity is real. But this is part of war's intoxication.
New York Times reporter Chris Hedges giving a commencement address in Rockford, Illinois. Yet the headline of the local newspaper report on that address as he got booed was "Speaker Disrupts Rockford College Graduation." He'd been invited by the college to give the address. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Iraqi National Congress is sharply criticizing the United States for delays in forming a transitional government to run Iraq. This according to a report in the Boston Globe. An INC spokesperson said his group will try to establish an interim government within a few weeks, regardless of U.S. support. The INC's Entifad Kanbar said, quote, "It is not up to the Americans to delay the interim government. This is a sovereign issue of Iraqis. We are allies of the United States. We do not take orders from the United States. We are going forward with our plans." Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting that the Iraqi citizens will now be required to hand over automatic weapons and heavy weapons in a U.S. effort to bring stability to the streets of Iraq. And in the latest hunt for weapons of mass destruction, today's New York Times has a front page piece co-written by Judith Miller, headlined "U.S. Analysts Link Iraq Labs to Germ Arms." The piece states the U.S. has concluded two mysterious trailers found in Iraq were germ warfare mobile units. But the article goes on to say the U.S. has found neither biological agents nor evidence that the equipment was ever used to make such arms. Fighting and fires continue to rage in Aceh, where the Indonesian military has launched the largest invasion in a quarter of a century. The London Independent reports at least 17 civilians were killed yesterday, and up to 200 schools have been set on fire. Hundreds of more Indonesian troops have parachuted into Aceh, where up to 40,000 police and soldiers are on the ground. Three helicopters also today fired rockets at suspected bases, they said, of the Free Aceh movement. Martial law was declared in Aceh on Monday. The Indonesian military has killed thousands of Acehnese over the last decade. New evidence of atrocities has surfaced in the northeastern Congo as aid workers discovered the bodies of 280 people in fighting. French military aides arrived in the country to assess whether it would deploy peacekeepers there. The UN wants France to lead an international force to stabilize the region. This comes shortly. The UN announced the two of its observers, a Jordanian and a Nigerian, had been, quote, brutally murdered in the Congo. Agence France-Presse reports it was the first time UN personnel had been deliberately killed since the mission was mandated in 1999. The U.S., Britain, and Germany have announced they will temporarily close their embassies in Saudi Arabia because information that more terror attacks may be imminent. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the Department of Homeland Security has increased the terror threat to level orange, the next to highest level. The triggers increase security measures at airports, government facilities, and other possible targets. This news just in from Afghanistan. U.S. troops have shot dead four Afghan soldiers and wounded four others outside the U.S. embassy in Kabul. Afghan soldiers said the U.S. troops mistakenly thought they were about to come under attack. The Bush administration announced plans Tuesday to greatly expand its controversial missile defense program beyond U.S. borders. This according to a report in the Los Angeles Times. A new White House document known as a National Security Presidential Directive declares that, quote, the U.S. will develop and deploy missile defenses capable of protecting not only the United States and our deployed forces, but also friends and allies. The program is no longer being referred to as a national missile defense system because it could be expanded to points across the globe. The administration hopes to deploy the initial system next year. Eventually, 6 missile defense sites are anticipated in Alaska, while 4 would be based at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. They would be part of a system of interceptors and lasers on land, on aircraft, and in space. Meanwhile, the Bush administration yesterday came a step closer to developing a new generation of nuclear weapons when the Senate voted to repeal a decade-old ban on research and development of low-yield nuclear weapons. The Pentagon wants to build more so-called mini-nukes, which have a blast equivalent of about one-third as large as the atom bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Opponents of the bill say it'll undermine efforts to discourage nuclear proliferation around the world. Advocates say the weapons could target enemies more precisely. The Pentagon announced yesterday the name of its massive surveillance system has been changed from Total Information Awareness to Terrorist Information Awareness. According to the Washington Post, the system would work to identify people from afar by the irises of their eyes, the grooves in their faces, or even their walking stride. And it would analyze droves of information on electronic databases, including financial, medical, educational, and biometric records, as well as airline ticket purchases and visa applications to pinpoint possible threats. Despite the name change, the American Civil Liberties Union described the system as an Orwellian program. The Electronic Freedom Forum dubbed it a giant suspicion-generating machine. The Justice Department admitted yesterday in a report to the House Judiciary Committee that it has been using the powers of anti-terrorism legislation signed after September 11th to pursue suspects in cases unrelated to terrorism. This includes drug violations, credit card fraud, and bank theft. In addition, the Justice Department, in its most detailed report on its post-September 11th work, reported federal agents have conducted hundreds of bugging and surveillance operations and visited numerous mosques and libraries. The Justice Department report also revealed that some 50 people have been detained without charges as material witnesses. The World Health Organization has adopted the first global public health measure, an anti-smoking treaty that aims to reduce the estimated 5 million smoking-related deaths each year. All 192 member states voted unanimously to adopt strict controls on the advertising, marketing, and sale of tobacco products within 5 years. The measure was initially opposed by tobacco-growing countries, including the United States and Germany. Over the weekend, the U.S. withdrew its opposition, but said constitutional free speech protections would prohibit it from adopting the advertising ban. A year ago, the Florida Audubon Society heralded the re-election of Jeb Bush as Florida's governor, saying it was good news for the Everglades. Well, yesterday, the president's brother signed a controversial law that may destroy a plan to save the marshland. The new bill is expected to delay cleanup of the Everglades by a decade. Environmental advocates accuse the governor of yielding to big sugar interests. And the House has passed a forest thinning bill that President Bush strongly backed. Opponents believed it is a cynical way for timber firms to get easier access to threatened forests, while supporters say it will cut the risk of forest fires. The legislation eases restrictions on the removal of underbrush and trees on 20 million acres of forest land. Forest Land. And finally, this news from St. Louis. The activist community is still reeling from a string of arrests and building raids that were carried out on Friday prior to the opening of the Biodevastation 7 conference and the World Agricultural Forum. All told, 27 people were arrested, including a group of bikers who were arrested for riding without a bike license. Two buildings closely linked to the activist community were also raided. Police claimed they had reports that weapons were inside. No weapons charges have been filed. Police did confiscate items ranging from CD-ROM drives to building supplies to diaries to puppets. At one of the buildings named Bolo Zone, 15 people were arrested for allegedly occupying a condemned building. The residents of the house said the building, which the city sold to the occupants last year, was only condemned on the morning of the raids. Matt Lemieux is executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Eastern Missouri. He said the St. Louis police used housing inspections as a, quote, trick to get in without a warrant. The ACLU also accused the police of preemptively arresting activists prior to the protest. We're joined by one of those arrested, Molly Bupre. Welcome, Molly.
Good morning.
Can you describe exactly what happened and have the police apologize for all they've done?
No, they haven't. On Friday morning of May 16th, myself and my roommates and our house guests, the Fabulous Flying Rutabaga Cycle Circus, who are in town to get ready to bike from here to D.C., some of us were in our house, some were in the yard, some people were in the alley. People were making puppets and painting banners that morning, and the police came. I was actually upstairs in my room. It was 10:30 in the morning. And two women ran into my room and said, the police are here in force. And I asked them if they had warrants. They said they closed and locked the front door because they didn't see warrants. And I went into the front room to look out the window to see what was happening. And as I was exiting that room, I heard our front door being kicked in. By the time I got in the middle room, police were coming up the stairs. And I repeatedly asked for warrants. And they said they didn't need warrants because we were occupying a condemned building. And they had showed up with a building inspector that morning and condemned our building, which we've been occupying for 4.5 years. We bought that building from the city 4.5 years ago, and it's been a home ever since, and we've been rehabilitating and nursing it back into a loving space. The police then stayed with me while I got dressed, and then they brought us all downstairs and out into the yard next door, and 15 of us were arrested for occupying a condemned building. A bunch of the people weren't even in the space. They were in they were on other property when they were arrested for this charge. We were then brought downtown and booked and held for 20 hours. A half an hour after we were raided, police showed up at the Community Arts and Media Project, which is a community center that houses various independent media organizations, including St. Louis Independent Media and a bike workshop and a free computer lab and things of that nature. And they also showed up with the building inspector, and that's how they got into the building. And searched it and took away puppets and journals and art supplies, and that's the kind of same thing that they took from our house.
They dropped the charges against the cyclists, saying originally that they had needed bicycle licenses?
They originally arrested them on, bike license charges, and then once
Do you need cycle licenses to ride a bicycle in St. Louis?
That was an old law. They repealed it 2 years ago because they never used it. Once they found out they couldn't be arrested on that, the police charged them with impeding the flow of traffic, even though they were on a bike trail in the park. They were charged with impeding the flow of traffic at an intersection very far from where they were.
And have people gotten their notebooks back and CD-ROMs and computers?
They confiscated 20 bikes from our house, and they slashed all the tires. We retrieved some of those 2 days ago. But other than that, the rest of our belongings haven't been returned. A lot of the circus kids can't perform their shows because their props have been taken, their puppets have been taken, and nothing has since been returned besides our bicycles.
Does the Biodevastation conference continue?
Pardon?
Does the Biodevastation conference continue?
That ended on Sunday. The World Agricultural Forum ended yesterday.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Molly Bupre, member of the St. Louis Community Arts and Media Project, one of 27 activists arrested last week prior to the World Agricultural Forum in St. Louis. You're listening to Democracy Now! Thank you.
just a living people.
Maybe not. Cat Power here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The headline in the Rockford Register Star in Illinois read, "Speaker Disrupts RC Graduation." The article describes how a commencement speaker was booed off the stage for making an anti-war speech at the Rockford College graduation on Saturday. The paper reports 2 days later, graduates and family members are, quote, still reeling. They had envisioned to, quote, go out and make your mark send off. The speaker was not an anti-war student, wasn't an anti-war faculty member. He was a New York Times reporter and veteran war correspondent, Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges reported from war-torn countries for 15 years. He spent the last year covering al-Qaeda cells in Europe and North Africa. He's a member of the New York Times team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for the paper's coverage of global terrorism. In his new book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, Chris Hedges writes, quote, "War and conflict have marked most of my adult life. I began covering insurgencies in El Salvador, where I spent 5 years, then went on to Guatemala and Nicaragua and Colombia through the First Intifada in the West Bank and Gaza, the civil war in Sudan and Yemen, the uprisings in Algeria and the Punjab, the fall of the Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu, the Gulf War, the Kurdish rebellion in southeast Turkey and northern Iraq, the war in Bosnia, and finally to Kosovo." Chris Hedges goes on to say in his book, "I've been in ambushes on desolate stretches of road in Central America, shot at in the marshes of southern Iraq, imprisoned in the Sudan, beaten by Saudi military police, deported from Libya and Iran, captured and held for a week by the Iraqi Republican Guard, strafed by Russian MiG-21s in the Bosnia, fired upon by Serb snipers, and shelled for days in Sarajevo." But this didn't stop the Rockford College officials from pulling the plug on his microphone, not once but twice during his commencement address this past weekend. The college president told Chris Hedges to wrap it up. He resumed his speech as the sound of boos and foghorns tried to drown him out. Some graduates and audience members turned their backs on the New York Times reporter. Others rushed up the aisle to protest the remarks. One student tossed his cap and gown at the stage before leaving. Well, Chris Hedges is with us for the hour. We will hear the address that he gave at Rockford College that was recorded there, and we'll also talk to him about his thoughts and what that speech was based on, and about his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Welcome to Democracy Now! Well, you experienced it firsthand. Just tell us what happened this weekend. Why'd you go to Rockford College in Illinois?
I was invited to give the commencement address, and given that the book is an explication of war and the poison that war is and what it does to individuals and societies, and that since the book came out, I have spoken extensively about that. That is, of course, what I was prepared to speak about when I got to Rockford. What I was not prepared for was the response, and I've certainly spoken at events where people disagreed. That's to be expected. But to be silenced and to have people clamber onto the platform with the threat of physical violence was something new and frightening.
Did the police actually have to take you off?
People had to be escorted. I think there were, you know, it's hard for me. I was trying to read the speech, so I wasn't sort of watching what was going on around me, but I believe about three students managed to get on the platform. They had to be escorted off, and then as the diplomas were being handed out, this campus security took me off campus. I mean, I left before the graduation ceremony was concluded.
Mm-hmm. And what was the response of other officials on the stage?
I think all of us were surprised at how vociferous the reaction was and how angry people were. You know, it began almost before I said anything, and I think you'll hear that in the tape. I really didn't manage to get much out before, significant sectors of the crowd began to drown me out, and made it very hard for anyone, I think, in the audience to hear what I was saying. So I really didn't have much of a chance to say anything.
Mm-hmm. You decided to continue the speech, though, from beginning to end.
The speech is longer than it was. It should have been a little longer. It was cut short, but I was determined not to let them determine when I would finish speaking. And I think the college president felt the same way. At the same time, he didn't want it to go on for another hour. But he didn't want to let the crowd determine that it was over. I didn't finish. No.
The mic was pulled twice, was cut off?
Right.
Who cut it?
I don't know. I don't know who cut it. I mean, it's probably cut at the source because there was nothing. I didn't see any activity around the podium.
We're talking to New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. We're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll hear the address that he gave at the graduation of Rockford College students this past weekend. Stay with us. Jorge Ben here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. Our guest in the studio for this hour is New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. His book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, went to Rockford College this weekend in Illinois to give the commencement address where he was booed off the stage. We're going to hear that address right now. This is Chris Hedges.
I want to speak to you today about war and empire. The killing, or at least the worst of it, is over in Iraq. Although blood will continue to spill, theirs and ours, be prepared for this. For we are embarking on an occupation that, if history is any guide, will be as damaging to our souls as it will be to our prestige and power and security. But this will come later. Our empire expands, and in all this we become pariahs, tyrants to others weaker than ourselves. Isolation always impairs judgment, and we are very isolated now. We have forfeited the goodwill, the empathy the world felt for us after 9/11. We have folded in on ourselves. We have severely weakened the delicate international coalitions and alliances that are vital in maintaining and promoting peace. And we are part now of a dubious troika in the war against terror with Vladimir Putin and Ariel Sharon, two leaders who do not shrink in Palestine or Chechnya from carrying out acts of gratuitous
and senseless violence. We have become the company we keep. The censure and perhaps the rage of much of the world, certainly one-fifth of the world's population, which is Muslim, most of whom, I will remind you, are not Arab, is upon us. Look today at the 14 people killed last night in several explosions in Casablanca. And this rage in a world where almost 50% of the planet struggles on less than $2 a day will see us targeted. Terrorism will become a way of life. And when we are attacked, we will, like our allies Putin and Sharon, lash out with greater fury. The circle of violence is a death spiral. No one escapes. We are spinning at a speed that we may not be able to hold. As we revel in our military prowess, the sophistication of our military hardware and technology, for this is what most of the press coverage consisted of in Iraq, we lose sight of the fact that just because we have the capacity to wage war does not give us the right to wage war. This capacity has doomed empires in the past. Modern Western civilization may perish, the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr warned, because it falsely worshipped technology as a final good. The real injustices, the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land, the brutal and corrupt dictatorships we fund in the Middle East, will mean that we will not rid the extremists who hate us with bombs. Indeed, we will swell their ranks. Once you master people by force, you depend on force for control. In your isolation, you begin to make mistakes. Fear engenders cruelty. Cruelty, fear, insanity, and then paralysis. In the center of Dante's circle, the damned remain motionless. We have blundered into a nation we know little about, are caught between bitter rivalries and competing ethnic groups and leaders we do not understand. We are trying to transplant a modern system of politics invented in Europe, characterized, among other things, by the division of the earth into the independent secular states based on national citizenship, in a land where the belief in a secular civil government is an alien creed. Iraq was a cesspool for the British when they occupied it in 1917. It will be a cesspool for us as well. The curfews, the armed clashes with angry crowds that leave scores of Iraqi dead, the military governor, the Christian evangelical groups who are being allowed to follow on the heels of our occupying troops to try and teach Muslims about Jesus. The occupation of the oil.
At this point, the microphone was cut. Chris
That's
Hedges?
Right. Yes.
You're listening to Chris Hedges attempting to give a graduation address at Rockford College in Illinois. And then the president stood up.
Well, we didn't know what had happened, so yes, the president stood up, and there was sort of a scramble to find out who had unplugged the microphone and whether it could be reconnected.
And this is what the president had to say. The space is the amount of time that it took to get the microphone reconnected.
My friends, one of the wonders of a liberal arts college is its ability in its deeply held commitment to academic freedom and to the decision to listen to each other's opinions. If you wish to protest the speaker's remarks, I would ask that you would do it in silence, as some were doing in the back. That is perfectly appropriate, but he has the right to offer this opinion here, and we would like him to continue with his remarks.
Chris, you then came over to the microphone.
Yeah, I came over and stood at the podium and waited in the hopes that maybe the crowd would die down a bit before I started, tried to start again. And then I began.
This is Chris Hedges giving the commencement address.
The curfews, the armed clashes with angry crowds that leave scores of Iraqi dead, the military governor, the Christian evangelical groups who are being allowed to follow on the heels of our occupying troops to try and teach Muslims about Jesus, the occupation of the oil fields, the notion that the Kurds and the Shiites will listen to the demands of a centralized government in Baghdad, the same Kurds and Shiites who died by the tens of thousands in defiance of Saddam Hussein, a man who happily butchered all of those who challenged him. And this ethnic rivalry has not gone away. The looting of Baghdad, or let me say the looting of Baghdad, with the exception of the oil ministry and the interior ministry, the only two ministries we bothered protecting, is self-immolation. As someone who knows Iraq, speaks Arabic, and spent 7 years in the Middle East, if the Iraqis believe, rightly or wrongly, that we come only for oil and occupation, they will begin a long, bloody war of attrition. It is how they drove the British out. And remember that when the Israelis invaded southern Lebanon in 1982, they were greeted by the dispossessed Shiites as liberators. But within a few months, when the Shiites saw that the Israelis had come, not as occupiers, not as liberators, but occupiers, they began to kill them. It was Israel who created Hezbollah. And it was Hezbollah that pushed Israel out of southern Lebanon. As William Butler Yeats wrote in Meditations in Times of Civil War, we had fed the heart on fantasies, the heart's grown brutal from the fair. This is a war of liberation in Iraq, but it is a war now of liberation by Iraqis from American occupation. And if you watch closely what is happening in Iraq, if you can see it through the abysmal coverage, you can see it in the lashing out of the terrorist death squads and the murder of Shiite leaders in mosques, the assassination of our young soldiers in the streets. It is one that will be soon joined by Islamic radicals. And we are far less secure today than we were before we bumbled into Iraq. We will pay for this, but what saddens me most is that those who will, by and large, pay the highest price are poor kids from Mississippi or Alabama or Texas who could not get a decent job or health insurance and join the army because it was all we offered them. For war, in the end, is always about betrayal. Betrayal of the young by the old, of soldiers by politicians, and of idealists by cynics. Read Antigone, when the king imposes his will without listening to those he rules, or Thucydides' history. Read how Athens' expanding empire saw it become a tyrant abroad and then a tyrant at home. How the tyranny the Athenian leadership imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. This, Thucydides wrote, is what doomed Athenian democracy. Athens destroyed itself. For the instrument of war, instrument of empire, is war. And war is a poison. It is a poison that at times we must ingest, just as a cancer patient must ingest a poison to survive. But if we do not understand the poison of war, if we do not know how deadly that poison is, it can kill us just as surely as the disease. We have lost touch with the essence of war. Following our defeat in Vietnam, we became a better nation. We were humbled, even humiliated. We asked questions about ourselves we had not asked before. We were forced to see ourselves as others saw us, and the sight was not always a pretty one. We were forced to confront our own capacity for atrocity, for evil, and in this we understood not only war, but more about ourselves. But that humility is gone. War, we have come to believe, is a spectator sport. The military and the press, and remember, in wartime, the press is always part of the problem, have turned war into a vast video arcade game. Its very essence, death, is hidden from public view. There was no more candor in the Persian Gulf War, or the war in Afghanistan, or the war with Iraq than there was in Vietnam. But in the age of live feeds and satellite television, the state and the military has perfected the appearance of candor. Because we no longer understand war, we no longer understand that it can all go horribly wrong. We no longer understand that war begins by calling for the annihilation of others, but ends if we do not know when to make or maintain peace with self-annihilation. We flirt, given the potency of modern industrial weapons, with our own destruction. The seduction of war is insidious because so much of what we are told about it is true. It does create a feeling of comradeship, which obliterates our alienation and makes us, for perhaps the only time in our life, feel we belong. War allows us to rise above our small stations in life. We find nobility in a cause and feelings of selflessness and even bliss. And at a time of soaring deficits and financial scandals and the very deterioration of our domestic fabric, war is a fine diversion. War for those who enter into combat has a dark beauty, filled with the monstrous and the grotesque. The Bible calls it the lust of the eye and warns believers against it. War gives us a distorted sense of self. It gives us meaning.
Can I share a few words here?
Once in war, when I finish, yeah. The conflict obliterates the past and the future. All is one heady, intoxicating present. You feel every heartbeat in war. Colors are brighter. Your mind races ahead of it.
At this point, Chris Hedges giving the graduation address in Rockford, Illinois. The mic is cut off for the second time. A minute ago, Chris, before we go back to the speech, we'll just speak through this silence. A man in the audience came up, said, "Can I say a few words here?" You said, "When I finish." He actually came up on the stage.
Yes.
And now we're beginning to hear in the background people are chanting louder. And of course, it's louder because the mic is directed toward you.
Right. Yeah, I think you don't sense how loud the crowd was. There were segments of the crowd that were very, very loud. But, of course, I had the microphone, so I was speaking directly into it.
So people were now up on the stage?
I think three people managed to get up on the stage. Of course, they tried to stop them. I noticed, you know, I was, of course, giving the talk, but I looked down and faculty or students, people in gowns, had actually done sort of a semicircle around some people who they thought would try and rush the stage.
Well, let's go back to the commencement address of New York Times reporter Chris Hedges in Rockford College.
We feel in wartime comradeship. We confuse this with friendship, with love. There are those who will insist that the comradeship of war is love. The ecstatic glow that makes us in war feel as one people, one entity is real. But this is part of war's intoxication. Think back on the days after the attacks on 9/11. Suddenly, we no longer felt alone. We connected with strangers, even with people we did not like. We felt we belonged, that we were somehow wrapped in the embrace of the nation, the community. In short, we no longer felt alienated. As this feeling dissipated in the weeks after the attack, there was a kind of nostalgia for its warm glow. And wartime always brings with it this comradeship, which is the opposite of friendship. Friends, as J. Glenn Gray points out, are predetermined. Friendship takes place between men and women who possess an intellectual and emotional affinity for each other. But comradeship, that ecstatic bliss that comes with belonging to the crowd in wartime, is within our reach. We can all have comrades. The danger, the external threat that comes when we have an enemy does not create friendship. It creates comradeship. And those in wartime are deceived about what they are undergoing. And this is why once the threat is over, once war ends, comrades again become strangers to us. This is why after war, we fall into despair. In friendship, there is a deepening of our sense of self. We become, through the friend, more aware of who we are and what we are about. We find ourselves in the eyes of the friend. Friends probe and question and challenge each other to make each of us more complete. In comradeship, the kind that comes to us in patriotic fervor, there is a suppression of self-awareness, self-knowledge, and self-possession. Comrades lose their identities in wartime for the collective rush of a common cause, a common purpose. In comradeship, there are no demands on the self. This is part of its appeal and one of the reasons we miss it and seek to recreate it. Comradeship allows us to escape the demands on the self that is part of friendship. In wartime, when we feel threatened, we no longer face death alone, but as a group, and this makes death easier to bear. We ennoble self-sacrifice for the other, for the comrade. In short, we begin to worship death, and this is what the God of War demands us. Think, finally, of what it means to die for a friend. It is deliberate and painful. There is no ecstasy. For friends, dying is hard and bitter. The dialogue they have and cherish will perhaps never be recreated. Friends do not, the way comrades do, love death and sacrifice. To friends, the prospect of death is frightening. And this is why friendship, or let me say love, is the most potent enemy of war. Thank you.
The college president, Paul Pribbenow, then stood up. This is the Rockford College president.
Graduates, faculty, staff, friends, and family. There are few places in the world like college communities where we still have the opportunities to come together and to deliberate on the issues that face us as a world. And we may not agree, but for 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, you have been a part of a community where you've been able to state your opinion in classrooms. You've been able to participate in conversations. And in this moment, we are in fact learning. We are participating in a teaching and learning community that's at the heart of our commitment to the liberal arts. We will now continue with our commencement exercises.
Rockford College President Paul Pribbenow, concluding after Chris Hedges was taken off the stage by police and security. When we come back, Chris Hedges will describe that experience and talk more about why he gave this address and his own personal experiences that led to the conclusions he shared with the 400 Rockford College students. Stay with us.
Tribal war in a Babylon. Is it out there? Who are you saying? Is it out there? Oh yeah. The Baba men no like the dreadlocks man. Oh. The dreadlocks man no like the Baba man. No.
Was War in Babylon, Max Romeo, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Chris Hedges, the commencement speaker at the Rockford College graduation this past Saturday in Illinois. I'm looking at the Rockford Register Star, the latest report out of there. As it says, the Rockford College family debated what went wrong at its spring graduation ceremony that featured New York Times reporter and anti-war advocate Chris Hedges. When do people listen to ideas? When do they think critically and disagree? When do people sit respectfully? And is there a time for civility to be lost? These and more questions discussed at a meeting on the campus, the alma mater of Jane Addams. Students, faculty, and staff didn't reach a consensus, but college president Paul Pribinow maintained students should be challenged by commencement speakers. He said, commencement is one of the last moments you have with students. I want commencement to be more than a pop speech. Well, Chris Hedges, you went to Jane Addams School, to Rockford College. Who was Jane Addams?
Well, she was one of the great moral and intellectual figures of the 20th century. She founded Hull House. She was, which was for immigrants, and this was sort of before the state got involved in social welfare, and I mean, she did amazing things like gather immigrants at Hull House to, they produced the first production of Sophocles' Ajax. I mean, she was just a remarkable figure, a remarkable intellect, and a pacifist who won the Nobel Prize for Peace and spoke out against World War I, against American entry into the war. And she was booed off the stage, for instance, in Carnegie Hall. So all I knew about Rockford College was this titanic figure in American intellectual and intellectual thought and moral, you know, one of the great sort of moral leaders of our country. So to be shouted down at her alma mater, there's a very sad kind of irony in that, of course.
So you were taken off by security?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what was so disturbing was that the crowd wasn't just angry, but there was that undercurrent or possibility of violence. I mean, the fact that people actually stormed up, you know, past those to get onto the podium. And there was a feeling that it was better to have me removed from the ceremony before the conclusion of the awarding of the diplomas. And so the campus security sort of hustled me out as they were handing out the diplomas.
I wonder if Jane Addams was treated in the same way when she was booed off a stage. Jane Addams, who, in addition to being founder of Hull House in Chicago, was the first international president of WILF, the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, and won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, she was a great figure. And, you know, if I take any comfort, it's that she would have not only understood, but I believe probably applauded.
And so let's talk about the conclusions that you've arrived at that you shared with the students. Did any come up to you afterwards to talk about why they had responded? And did you have a sense that it was a majority or just a vocal minority?
I don't think it was a majority, but it was a significant minority. I mean, large enough that they disrupted the commencement exercises. No one could really, a few people, or two, if I believe. I mean, it was all sort of a rush. As I was escorted to the car to leave, I think two students tried to come up to me just to say thank you. But I wasn't really able to talk to students afterwards.
You had originally planned to do.
Yes, I certainly didn't plan to leave immediately.
Hmm. You are author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. You have reported from many war zones. You've been in Guatemala. You've been in El Salvador. You've been in Bosnia. You were in the Iraq, the Persian Gulf War. You were held by Iraqi Republican Guard. Can you talk about some of those experiences?
Well, you know, as I looked out on the crowd, that's exactly what my book is about. It is about the suspension of individual conscience and probably consciousness for the contagion of the crowd, for that euphoria that comes with patriotism. The tragedy is that, and I've seen it in conflict after conflict or society after society that plunges into war, is that with that kind of rabid nationalism comes racism and intolerance and a dehumanization of the other. And it's an emotional response. People find a kind of ecstasy, a kind of belonging, a kind of obliteration of their alienation in that patriotic fervor that always does come in wartime. And that's what I, as I gave my talk and I looked out on the crowd, I was essentially witnessing things that I had witnessed in the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina or in squares in Belgrade or anywhere else. You know, crowds, especially crowds that become hunting packs, are very frightening. And people chanted the kind of cliches and aphorism and jingos that are handed to you by the state, God bless America, or people were chanting send him to France or this kind of stuff. And that kind of contagion leads ultimately to tyranny. It's very dangerous, and it has to be stopped. And I've seen it infect and take over countries. But of course, it breaks my heart when I see it in my country. But that's essentially what I was looking at. In some ways, was a mirror of what I was trying to speak about. And I think I managed to touch upon it somewhat when I talked about this notion of comradeship as a suppression of self-awareness and self-possession to sort of follow along locked in the embrace of a nation or of a group or a national group unthinkingly, blindly. And there is a kind of undeniable euphoria in that, and that's what I was looking at. I mean, this was a visceral and emotional reaction. It was nobody really spent much time, or I didn't really have much time to begin to explain the thoughts that I was getting across. And of course, it was interpreted as anti-military, which it is not. I mean, this is, you know, what I write about in the book, and what I speak about is about war, how war is used as an instrument, the danger of war, why war should always be a last resort, what the use of war, what happens when we wage war without justifiable cause? What happens to ourselves? What happens to others? I mean, this is the currency of the book, and something that I'm sort of ringing, the alarm bells against. And there was a kind of symbiotic relationship between everything that I've experienced and written and what was happening in that crowd.
Mm-hmm. What has been the response of your newspaper, The New York Times?
Well, they're looking into whether I breached the protocol in terms of, my very pointed statements about the Iraqi war. I mean, that's something that makes them uncomfortable. I don't think they have a problem with the book because the book talks more generically about what war does to societies, although certainly does mention what it's done to us since 9/11. So that's something that they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. What pressures do you face? I mean, New York Times, not exactly in their reporting of the invasion, like many other papers, you don't have to single them out, including television news, beating the drums for war. You take a very different stance.
Well, up until now, I haven't faced any pressure at all. And I have spoken before. But because of the anger that this talk elicited, I think there's been more attention to the kinds of things that I've said. So, I mean, one of the pressures I face is, you know, a proliferation of sort of hate phone calls and hate emails, which I had had periodically, but of course now I have daily.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll continue to follow what happens in this. The right-wing media has certainly picked this up.
Right.
What's happening? Are you getting a lot of calls?
Yeah, well, I don't do trash talk, you know, radio. I didn't before, and I'm not going to start now. And since I don't own a television, I'm sort of spared being inflicted with this stuff. So.
And you've written a new book.
Yes, I have. It's called What Every Person Should Know About War, and I think this book is, it's really in some ways geared towards those 17 and 18 year old kids who believe the myth of war. I mean, I think both books are an attempt to demythologize war and explain war as it is. And it you know, the Army has studied at length what war does to individuals, how to create more efficient killers, and it goes through and answers a lot of those questions that, you know, if they get asked, often don't get answered.
Well, we'll have you back on to discuss that book. The book that Chris Hedges has been speaking about most recently, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, New York Times reporter. Thank you very much for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you, Amy.
And that does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is headed to Atlanta today. I'll be testifying at the final public hearing, though unofficial, of the upcoming FCC rule changes on media ownership. FCC Chair Michael Powell is pushing an accelerated deregulation of the media, which will allow an unprecedented consolidation of media ownership. His new rules are due to be voted on June 2nd. The hearing will include testimony of the two dissident members of the FCC, Adelstein and Copps. It's from 6 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. We will stream it on our website at democracynow.org. And Pacifica's Verna Avery Brown will host a four-hour live coverage of that hearing. Any Pacifica or community radio station can run it in the country. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Noah Reibel, and Vilka Tsouras helped today, as well as Mike DeFilippo and Rich Kim. If you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman.